When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis and today I'm with Brad. How are you doing today?
I'm awesome, Dennis. It's great to be back with you today. How are you?
I'm doing well. And you are definitely the perfect guy to talk to about today's topic. Of gas anesthesia and how much better it is than what we're doing. So,
I am definitely a guy to talk about passing gas. Yes, correct.
No, I've been around when you talk. Like
that's right. I can fill the room. Yeah.
Since. You know, fairly recently we did a podcast, so I think we can probably skip the introductions quick and just kind of jump into the topic. So way back in the day when I went through the school, we did gas anesthesia and like as a note, we did some IV drip anesthesia. Now things have drastically changed and we only do drip anesthesia. I guess, is there a good reason why we changed or?
Well, I think part of that, it's hard to say when things start to shift. Sometimes it is kind of a new hotness type of a thing. Whenever, you know, I brought a lot of the Teva technique with the ketamine versus drips in, and a lot of it was, well, we don't have vaporizers in the field. You know, to do this a certain way, like we do in the schoolhouse. Part of that was a safety thing. Part of it was logistics of it. Mm-hmm. I'm not running around with a vaporizer like you learned on in the schoolhouse in my backpack. You know, what can I do with a very small amount of cube and space in my bag? And so that, I think, drove a lot of the Teva type techniques. People understood them pretty well. And then what started to happen, I think, though, was it was like, oh, well, we'll just get rid of gas, you know, completely. And we'll just shift to this and this solves all the problems. And okay, let's do that. I'm not saying it was quite that, you know, direct, but which is a answer. It's not always the greatest answer because, you know, there may be situations where you're deployed in certain situations that, I don't know, you're out of ketamine, you're out of fentanyl versus, you know, and lo and behold, this may be what I have, you know, depending on the environment you're in a lot of these developing countries. And how am I going to get this done? And is it a way? And it's absolutely a way. One, you know, because one of the things, you know, we'll talk about a little bit is that gas anesthesia from the very beginning, it's the hallmark of what started all of anesthesia all the way back in 1846. And ether was the gas of the day at that time. And gas covers all the aspects of what general anesthesia is. Okay, instead of having to mix different drugs in and things in the bag, gas does it all. And we'll talk about that a little bit as well. But a part of it is, as far as when you are doing gas anesthesia, is, you know, we're back to the before I do anything part of any type of a sedation or any type of a deeper sedation, you know, you always have to make sure that your mismate is done in the beginning. Okay. And if people that haven't heard mismate, I don't want to run back through all the details of mismate, but As a part of that, you know, the very first thing on the M of MissMade is the machine. It's the anesthesia machine in the operating room it is. If you're in a field environment, you would hope to have at least the IUPAC Omida drawover that's the deployed type of a system that you guys trained on in the schoolhouse. And then, you know, the NATO countries have what's called the tri-service vaporizer as well. Mm-hmm. And that's a great little piece of kit if you have it, because it can vaporize different types of gas, not just one type. And so that's interesting. But it's not FDA approved, so to speak, to be using that in all types of environments like back here in the States. Now, we were able to train on it because we checked certain boxes with the FDA to train people in deployment anesthesia in the hospital where I trained at Madigan. And we had a room set up to where that we could do that and actually train on that device, because there are a lot of quirks to it. And one of the reasons that it wasn't FDA approved was because it doesn't have all the bells and whistles to alarm at you and tell you there's something going wrong. You know, one of those things is the gas analyzer that you're typically not going to have in any kind of a field environment. And I'll kind of talk about that in a little bit, but the gas analyzer is the thing that analyzes the anesthesia gas going in and coming out, and it actually gives you a percent, so you know how asleep that person is, so to speak. And you're not going to have that with, you know, the environment that we're talking about. So
right.
You have to be hyper vigilant if you're using gas as the person, and as a part of being the monitor part of the MissMade. You know, this isn't one of those things that you walk away from. If you're going to do it, you're in it. Okay. You are managing the airway, which you're also managing the gas of the anesthesia. You're monitoring constant vital signs. So you're constantly measuring pulse. You're looking at the respiratory rate, the quality of the respirations, BP, at least I'd like it every 3 minutes, but, you know, 3 to 5 minutes. So it's a full-time job up there whenever you're administering gas anesthesia, because, you know, if you were to walk away from it, so to speak, well, I'll do this and I'll go down there and I'll work on the guy's leg, they're going to wake up, you know. So it's not one of those deals. You need to have somebody that's in charge of running that. So I think that's a little bit of it. And the other thing to talk about, too, is like we're talking about gas anesthesia as the sole agent. Now, they're doing gas anesthesia in every OR every single day. And the great thing about that is, as a medic or any kind of a practitioner, you know, you can go in, talk to the CRNAs or the anesthesiologist, and say, you know, here's why I'm here, and this is what I want to look at. I want to watch how gas anesthesia is done. However, they are doing combined techniques in the operating room. So they're using narcotics. They're using a lot of times muscle relaxants, and there's more things added on, and it's not a pure gas anesthetic like we're talking about that you could do in the field, okay? However, that being said, the best place to go in and witness the stages of anesthesia is to get into the OR and watch what is going on. Now, the key to that is, all too often what happens when guys come into the operating room is they normally come in, and the reason they're coming in is they're coming in to intubate, which is great. You know, I want to come in, I want to, secure the airway. I want to see what that's like. And that's fantastic. So they see the induction piece of the anesthetic, but they normally are off. Once they get it, they're normally off to another room to do it again. And they don't see the waking up piece of it, which is critical. And that's where, in the modern operating room, that's where you're going to actually see the stage two that we're going to talk about. That's the danger stage, and that's the one that you really want to be able to identify. So that's key. Now, from the historical side of it, like I was talking about before, you know, this started in Boston, Massachusetts, up at Mass General Hospital in 1846, long time ago. And Dr. Morton was a dentist who actually did the first successful demonstration of ether for a general surgery type of a case. And so much so, it took off so much that that observation surgery area was named the Ether Dome, because that's all they did after that. You know, every day, you know, ether, ether, ether. And they would come in and, you know, people would watch the surgeries and, wow, this isn't, you know, barbaric anymore. We can actually have a patient that can hold still, that we can do complicated type things and save people's lives. Fantastic. You know, ether was so good. It was used all the way up into the 1980s, even in the United States. Now, it really started trailing off in the 1960s when some of the other agents came along. And the key with those other agents that came along was that they weren't flammable or explosive. Okay. And like it or not, that's the drawback of ether. Okay. Is that it is flammable big time. Okay. And if it gets exposed to too much light, it can form crystals and technically it can explode. Okay. We switched to other agents like isoflurane, halothane. There's more out there, but, you know, again, probably using isoflurane back going through the schoolhouse when you were using the vaporizer. It's been around for quite a while as well. But the truth is, ether was a great anesthetic. You know, it was very safe. It just caught fire and blew up, you know, and
is a downside.
It's a downside, you know. I wouldn't be using it on any aircraft. Some crew chief would lose his mind, right? Unless I'm starting an engine. But the thing about it was, you got to remember also is, one of the great things, you know, when you were talking to Dave Harden recently about austere surgery, and Dave was talking about, you know, you got to communicate between the team. And I'm talking before the surgery ever starts, you know, you got a war game, what's going on. If you were in there using ether today, that means you better tell everybody, because there better not be any electric cautery going on or any bovipens or anything that's going to produce a spark, or you're going to have the time of your life. Okay, that type of a situation. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but people forget about that piece of it. And they say they remember, but they really don't. Early on, there was another popular anesthetic called chloroform, which I'm sure if anybody's watched any old movie and they poured it on the rag and threw it on somebody's face, it knocked people out. And, you know, they would kidnap people with chloroform and yada, yada. Chloroform was great because it was better tolerated when you smelled it. Mm-hmm. And it worked much faster than ether to knock people out. Problem with chloroform later, they figured out, was it caused like cardiac arrhythmias and had some liver toxicity as well. And so later on, it fell out of favor. But it was very, you know, back in like World War I, World War II, it was very popular to put somebody to sleep originally with chloroform because it would work faster, and then they would switch to ether once they were asleep, you know, type of a deal. But you know, it's gone the way of the dodo as well. But you know, again, they were doing a lot of these cases back then without all the bells and whistles that we have today. And they were doing that by being very vigilant with the airway, the heart rate, the blood pressures. Once the blood pressure came on the scene, to be able to vigilantly monitor the patient. Now, what I was talking about before, one of the great things about gas anesthesia is if that's all that you have, it covers every aspect of general anesthesia by itself. That is one of the huge benefits of gas, and it always was. I think I was telling you before, there's actually a training video on YouTube from 1944. And if you look it up, you just type in open drop ether number two, 1944. And it brings up this black and white training video from back then. And they are doing open abdominal surgery with nothing but an ether bottle and a gauze mask on the patient. And they go through the whole thing. It's really interesting about, you know, study your history type of a deal. So the deal is that, you know, the hallmarks are, it gives you the reversible loss of consciousness. You get whole body analgesia with it. You get amnesia with it. And you get a degree of muscle relaxation without using muscle relaxants to a degree. If you're using just the sole agent part of it. Now the muscle relaxation piece has to do with the deeper that you take the patient, the more muscle relaxation that you will get. It's never going to be on the same level as using like Becuronium or those types of things, but you will get some muscle relaxation. And like I said, they were doing open abdominal procedures and things along those lines. So that leads us to what we call the stages of anesthesia that was created by Goodell back in the day. And this goes all the way back to your World War One type stuff, World War II type stuff, of the things that they noticed doing just gas anesthesia. And these are the things that you can still witness parts of these today in the modern operating room. Especially, like I'm saying, if you stay all the way through the case and watch the wake-ups at the end of the case. But he broke it down into basically four stages. And stage one was from how we are right now, basically to you think about your conscious sedation levels, you know, your mild, moderate, you know, heavy sedation levels. And then once you start to go a little bit deeper than that, that's what we call stage two. That's the danger zone that we run into. Okay. Because in stage two, they are not awake, even though people think they are because their patient will still move around, but it's an excited delirium type of a state. Okay. And you got to remember the last sense in the body to go to sleep is your hearing. And it kills me whenever you're waking up a patient, how everyone in the room wants to yell and scream, you know, right. And, you know, you're putting somebody in kind of like hell, you know, when you're doing that. So you gotta remember that piece. But stage two is the danger zone because of a few things. One, the jaw, the masseter muscles get very, very tight so that it's harder to deal with any kind of an airway issue at that point. One of the hallmark signs of it is, their breathing becomes very irregular, even to the point they'll hold the breath, you know, and that's a problem because when they hold their breath and you're trying to get them down into where our goal is down into stage three is like, they're not breathing any more gas in. Okay. They're in kind of this in between zone. So a lot of people kind of like, oh, they want to back off at that point. It's like, no, you gotta keep going at that point, you know?
Yeah.
So there's breath holding, there's gasping. That's where you can get the laryngospasms in the airway. Again, that's your danger zone. And one of the other telltale signs is when you lift the eyelids back, the eyes have a disconjugated stare. And once you see that in the operating room, you won't mistake it really for anything else. You know, I mean, you peel them back and you're like, whoa, okay, I see that. I know what that is now. That's another sign, like I'm in the danger zone right now. I need this person, if I'm putting them to sleep, I need to keep going and get them down and get them down to that stage three. Now, the thing about today's anesthesia, we use gas all the time, but for safety issues and also because of speed, we take people and we use the IV induction agents such as propofol, etomidate, ketamine. And the reason we do that is because we want to take them from awake all the way through the stage two really fast, right to stage three. And now I don't have to deal with that. I'm all the way down and now I can intubate the patient, secure the airway, and it's much safer to do it that way. And that's why we do that. But again, however, once they're down there, they got to come back up. And that's where waking up That's the zone. And that's what I'm saying. If you go to the OR and watch this, you're going to see every single patient come up through stage two. And you can witness it and see like, okay, I know what that looks like now. That's where things can be seriously trouble for me type of a deal.
If I could ask you now, just a quick question about waking patients up. Now, from what I remember, gas versus using something like propofol or we didn't have fentanyl or ketamine. We just had, if I remember right, we used a lot of morphine. We had a tiny bit of ketamine, but I want to say we used that as like the sedative and we induced with propofol. If I remember correctly, when we did use the gas, they said the benefit was reversal of the gas was a lot faster than using like your systemic agents, like your ketamine and definitely morphine. And so they would be able to recover faster. Is that true for gases or?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'll caveat that. Gas is a direct correlation, to how much of it you were using and how long you were using it for. And this is like years of anesthesia school, you know what I mean? Yeah. But all the tissues of the body absorb the gas differently. And at different amounts. And so fat's different than muscle, that's different than bone, that's different than, okay. And so the solubility of the gas has a big factor to do with that. The more soluble the gas is, the longer it takes to get somebody to sleep, that's ether. Mm-hmm. And the longer it is to wake them up, because it takes longer for it to leach back out of their system to get to their lungs to then breathe it off, to get it out of their brain so that they can wake up. Yep. Okay. Whereas IV anesthetics, like your propofol, you know, that's going to last 7 minutes, yep. You know, boom, you know, you give it, they go to sleep. Where people get confused is it's like, so we put somebody to sleep with propofol and then you're in there intubating and doing those things. And we're reaching behind you on the anesthesia machine. We're already turning the gas on. So right. as soon as you hook up to the ventilator, or the bag, they're getting all that gas in quickly, and we have it way turned up so that before they wake up from the propofol, the gas keeps them down at that stage three level and that kind of plane three level of stage three of what we're looking for. Okay. But that's why it's important to go and watch the wake-ups. Yep. You know, because you can literally, at least in the operating room, it's awesome because that gas analyzer, I can see the percentage and I can literally with every breath, watch it go down fast or slow. And I can tell when that person's going to start to wake up type of a deal. So partially, if you didn't use very much gas and you didn't use it very long, it can go away pretty quick. It's just not the norm when you're using gas, especially if you're using gas just by itself, because you used it probably a lot getting them down to stage three. And then therefore there's a chunk coming out. It just takes time.
So I screwed it up.
No. That's an absolutely great question, man, because, you know, it's sometimes things are a little backwards with the way that you kind of perceive of what they are, but it also depends on the agent, you know, like I'm saying, oh yeah. Yeah. So some of the newer gases, which are very expensive and they're very precise, they go on fast. They come off fast, really to save time, again, time and money in the operating room. But you're not going to see those gases, desflurane. You're not going to see that in the field. It needs a special vaporizer and you're just not going to see it. So it is a time thing and it's how much gas that I actually have to use on that person. Yeah. Now, once you get them down towards stage three, we're going through that stage two, that danger zone. You know, how do I know that I'm down in that stage three zone that's where I want to be? I'm looking for things like automatic breathing. So the jerky breathing or holding the breath, those kinds of things will stop my automatic breathing centers take over. So breathing becomes, you know, very, very stable, or it should. The eyeballs, like I was talking about before, will come back to the midline and look more normal. And that's another really good way to realize you've gone from two to three. The muscle relaxation starts to paralyze the intercostal muscles some. And so your breathing becomes more from the diaphragm at that point as well. That's another way to kind of look at it. And that's where you want to be without getting too complicated into it. And that's where you want to. That's where you want to hold your patient. There is stage four that we never want to go to. That is basically cardio collapse. The respiratory center is shut down. They're not breathing, and death follows. So we don't want to be down there. Type of thing. So all that being said, talking about a few of the characteristics of the gases. One of the big ones you may hear is what's called a MAC value, M-A-C, which stands for minimum alveolar concentration. Now, each gas has a MAC value, and that's a relative number to things like age. And kids are a little bit different, their number, than adult versus elderly. But it is a starting point, and what it really means is not how much gas they're breathing in, but it's how much gas that's coming out. Mm-hmm. And that's a way to measure what's being seen in the brain. And once you hit what's called one MAC, that is where if you made a surgical incision, 50% of the people wouldn't move at all, but 50% of the people might move some. Okay. And when you're doing pure gas, people forget, like, they may move and you may have to give them a little bit more because they just need a little bit more. The way I kind of talk about that is, like, since guys now are very used to doing the ketamine drips that I taught them, that calculation that I give them, right? That kilogram body weight divided by two, that's my cc's per hour start with that drip that we do. That's a starting point. That's not an absolute. You know, I may have to go up, or I may can turn it down a little bit. So when you look at these, isoflurane has a MAC value of 1.15%, if I could see it on the gas analyzer. All right. Halothane, which you may run into downrange still, it's banned in the United States now, but it's still popular in the developing worlds because it's very cheap. It can be very safe. It's got liver toxicity issues, is why the FDA banned it here. Its MAC value is 0.75% approximately. And ether kind of has a more wide range to it, where it's anywhere from like 2%, but you'll see 3%, 4%, 5%. And that has to do with how soluble it is in the person. And it also has to do with how pure the ether actually is that you're using, type of a deal. So my goal should be, you know, at least one MAC to be able to do most of the things that we're talking about doing to get somebody into stage three. They're safe, and that's where I want to keep them. The problem is I don't have the gas analyzer to read that number. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? In the field environment we're talking about. So I have to rely on the things like the heart rate, the blood pressure. How is their breathing looking? What do their eyeballs look like? Are they in that straight, not disconjugated look? I have to rely on those types of things, those physical things that I can pick up on, not the machine, to tell me what it is, kind of a deal. So the other thing to remember about some of these gases is, remember I was talking about before, ether being flammable and explosive. Anesthesia gas in the field, or let me back up a step. In the operating room, we have an elaborate scavenging system where the waste gas that the patient is blowing out gets sucked, you know, into the completely different place, and it's vented out, and no harm, no foul. It's not floating around the room, in other words. In the austere environment, every time, you know, people bring up, well, I'm using the vaporizer, or I want to do the open air technique, you know, the 1940s, you know, type of deal. This is what I'm going to do. And you need to understand that waste gas coming off of that patient is in the room. Mm-hmm. Okay. Especially if you're doing the open mass technique. And Mike may talk about that when he's doing that. If you're doing something like that, you don't want to have your face all the way down next to the patient, because you're getting it too. And you may go down before he does, you know, that kind of thing. Right. Sounds crazy, but I'm here to tell you. Also, anesthesia gas is heavier than air. So what it will do is, you may have seen like old World War I movies with chlorine gas, how it settled mm-hmm. into the trenches, it made it so deadly, and it would crawl along, but you could see it because it had a green tint to it. Imagine that. Anesthesia gas is on the floor, floating around, hovering down there, or it's on the tabletop at first. It will literally travel across the tabletop, and then as it comes off, it will dip down to the down onto the floor. And it will search things out. So it will search out if it's ether, flame, you know, and that's the danger behind it. Right. So if I am in a house doing this, I'm in some safe house somewhere and somebody has a gas stove with a pilot light, shut it off. If you're doing something like this, you know, or the hot water heater or the crappy candles, generator that's run. Yeah. Candles. Yeah. That's a whole nother story, a Walt Hetzler story I could tell you about doing anesthesia in Vietnam in a barn. But it's not just ether. Isofluorane will do it. Halothane will do it. Any of the gases are going to kind of travel down there. And, yeah, they're not going to catch on fire. But let's say you drop something onto the floor and you went down there searching for it and you're crawling around on the floor too long, you might pass out. You know right. what I mean? So. Again, it's got some quirks to it. And because the waste gas is not being taken away, like in the operating room, it's something that you have to consider and warn people about as well. Kind of a deal. Delivery systems. I would hope that when we're talking about this, that you've got a vaporizer and we're talking about either the tri-service or the one that you guys trained on in schoolhouse. The IUPAC vaporizer, that thing's great if you know how to use it, type of a deal. And there's little quirks to it, but one of the great things, if you ever trained on it, was, man, you could use it in so many different ways. And compared to any other type of anesthesia machine, it really was light, packable into a small case. Even a backpack, it's going to be a little heavy, but and it just had so many different gases that you could use with it, including ether even, that it was very, you could take it almost to any country and find a gas that you were going to be able to use with that vaporizer and therefore be able to, with the dial on the top, it's got the MAC values on the dial. So it's got the percentages when you're turning it. You did this at the schoolhouse. You know, isofluorine, you could turn it to that one, let's say 1.2% and be close, you know, type of thing. And so you think, even though you don't have a gas analyzer, you're in the ballpark of what you ought to see if I did have a gas analyzer. That makes it much safer. And I'm able to have better control for what I'm doing type of thing versus the open air technique.
Yep.
Now, like I said, in that 1944 video, they do a good job of showing how, you know, you take something like this is a Schimmelbusch mask that kind of comes apart. And basically, you would put about 5 pieces of gauze on the top of this, right? And it would pinch the gauze down in here, and it looks just like a mask okay, that I'm going to put onto the patient. And then I would have my bottle of ether, and it had its two little tubes coming out of it called a Bellamy dropper. And I would just start to gently pour that onto the face of the patient through the gauze, not directly, obviously. Yeah. And it's funny, they had a very good technique where it was very specific. You had to have 5 or 6 pieces of gauze, because if you only have 1 piece of gauze, it turned into waterboarding. You know what I mean? That's not good, right? versus If you put too many pieces of gauze on it, it's hard to breathe through, and they couldn't pick up the vapor as well. So it just didn't work as well. So they kind of had a sweet spot with the 5 or 6 pieces of gauze. And so, you know, they literally, that's how anesthesia was done, with the bottle and the gauze mask, or just straight gauze, if that's all that they had at that point in time. But again, you're bringing in all those other effects. You know, the waste gas is everywhere, especially on the floor, especially if it's ether. You know, so there's a lot. It looks easy. It ain't as easy as it looks. Because you got to remember, those people trained on that, and they were very astute in what they were doing. And everybody was on the same sheet of music with how they were doing that. But it can be done. You know, that is the other thing. With very limited amount of supplies, you know, it can be done. You can also not just drop ether. Halothane can work that way. I've never seen isoflurane done that way, because it never had to be done that way. But something to consider. The one thing about ether, when people always bring this up to me, is you have to remember, though, that ether has a boiling point of about 94, 95 degrees. And if you get in a very, very hot climate, you can't just pour it out of the bottle. It will literally boil and vaporize before it ever gets to the mask. Type of a deal. And so when you go back and look at some of the old school ways they would deal with that, is they would make these ether jar type setups. You know, there's just the old mason jar setup. And they would put cotton balls in here. And, you know, the ether would soak up into the cotton ball, so it wouldn't just boil off right off the bat. And then they would have the patient basically breathe through this tube, and then the other tube was to allow, obviously, the air to come in. They let them breathe it for a while, and then they take it away from them, almost like a fentanyl lollipop kind of a deal, you know?
Yeah.
Like, once they got where they want, well, let me take it away for a minute, you know, type of deal. But there were different types of those contraptions, you know, back in the day. If you were in a very hot environment and just pouring it onto the gauze just wasn't going to work. So you can think of like the Philippines or Iraq or, you know, any of those places where if it's 120 degrees outside, you know, it's going to be a long day, because it's not going to work, you know, kind of a deal. So there's that as far as like the delivery side of the house. And the other thing I always kind of warn people about, because we go down some of these rabbit holes, is that if I have a vaporizer, I damn sure better be using the vaporizer, not doing the open air technique, right? or if I watch the 1944 video and they're like, well, they didn't use pulse oxes and they didn't use entitled CO2 and they, you know, and everything was fine. It's like, yeah, but if I've got it and you're not using it, that's the wrong damn answer, period.
Right. They also killed a lot of people.
Yeah. It was not as safe back then because of those inventions, right? So don't ever come to me and be like, I was just too lazy to put the pulse ox on, you know, or I just, you know, was too lazy to, I had entitled CO2, but nah, you know, like, nah, it's the wrong answer, dude. You know, same thing with the gas. It's like, if I have a vaporizer, yes, I absolutely better be using it, because it's going to be better control and you know, safer to use than it is just the open air technique. So that being said,
one quick question. So entitled, I have an Emma, so that's obviously going to be in line with my airway. You have the gas going through the monitor. Does that throw off your entitled readings, or do those two things not mix at all?
No, they don't mix at all. In fact, like, back to the RGM side of the house, the gas analyzer in the OR, the reason it's so expensive and so big is it analyzes all the gases all at once, you know, kind of a thing. The EMA just happens to be geared to pick up on the CO2 type of the house. But the other, if desflurane is going through that same tube, it's just not going to affect it. You know, in fact, when the M's first came out, you know, because where I worked, a big part of what we do is research and development and testing and evaluation of all the stuff, you know, that would come out. We were able to take them into the OR and safely hook them up and also be able to see what the real machine was using and correlate those values, you know,
okay,
and be able to say, like, the EMA says end-tidal CO2 is 40, the RGM or whichever gas analyzer I have says 40, okay, or it's close, 39, 40, you know.
Yeah.
And we never saw anything like, because we were using anesthesia gas at the same time, and there was no, like, you know, big discrepancy in the two. So yeah, you can actually absolutely hook it up and trust the number, okay, as long as, you know, you've got the mass sealed and everything's working properly. Sure.
Right.
That's a good question. Yeah.
So another question about the mask. So I have seen going into the ORs, just watching, nobody lets me touch anything.
That's a wrong answer. They should let you touch. Come on, man.
I don't look like I belong anywhere, right?
Okay. Me either, dude. Yeah.
But they don't always intubate everybody. Sometimes, right, I've seen them with just an OPA. They have a patent. They make sure that they have a patent airway. They don't always have a secure airway. Is it, especially since I'm taking this person, you know, to that level three, so I can do surgery on them.
Sure.
Shouldn't we always secure their airway?
No, you don't have to. And in fact, a lot of it depends on the surgery. It depends on the patient. There's multiple things that goes into that question. But quite often, if I don't have to go through the little bit of trauma of putting an endotracheal tube through your vocal cords, I'm not going to. You know, if there's not a reason to do that, I can, plenty of surgeries get done around the world with things like the LMA you know, and King LT is another kind of a thing to use like that. And they're breathing anesthesia gas through it as well. You know what I mean? The other, type of case that we still do today, where you don't use anything but just straight gas normally, is with kids having PE tubes put in.
Yep.
And that is a very fast case. It's a mask induction. It's a legitimate, no kidding, mask induction where they actually do go through stage two going to sleep. And then they come through stage two waking back up. It's just harder to get into the OR to see that. You know, with what you're kind of saying, it's very easy to go see the other cases, kind of a thing. So, you know, yes, we can absolutely do a lot of these things with just a mask. If it's just, I will tell you this, if you're doing a mask case, and they made us do it in school, guess what? You cannot use the LMA. You're going to do mask cases today. And you're like, oh my God. Cause it's a pain, dude. And if you really want to get down to it, it's like, well, how about I put this LMA in? It's just as safe. And I don't have to sit here, you know, and deal with this airway. Cause my hand's like in a, you know, a claw cramp. Cause all I'm doing is holding this mask on, but they make you do it to prove the point. But it's a very good question, you know, because it can absolutely be done safely depending on the surgery. And depending on, you know, the patient not having some comorbidity that says, no, you shouldn't do that, you know, type of a deal. So, yeah, no, that's a great question.
Because I know, like with ketamine, especially using ketamine, I use a lot of ketamine. You get that hypersalivation and always worry about, like, like, it could be an airway risk. Do I want to constantly be playing games or do I just want to secure the airway and be done with it?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, it depends on in the field. You got to remember securing the airway may be the only option, and it may be the safest option, and you do it. Securing the airway in the field, though, a lot of times means putting a crike in versus I don't bring all my stuff to do the intubations, and that's all changed, right?
Yeah.
So can I get the crike in? Is it worth getting the crike in? Do I have to get the crike in? You know, how far am I willing to go with this deal? Where I could have just done this with a mask. I could have done it safely and not, you know, cut the dude's throat, you know, kind of a deal, struggling kind of a thing. So I also think it's important to realize, like, you can do just sedation cases with gas. Mm-hmm. And sedation cases are just in that stage one. You don't even go to stage two. You know, you just keep them in that stage one and that kind of, you know, kind of twilight sleep zone and do whatever you need to do. And then they actually wake up pretty quick. That's actually another way to do it as well, you know, kind of a thing. So, but no, great question, man. Yeah. Good but deal. You can absolutely do it safely. Yeah. Okay. So some of the pros of gas that we've been talking about, you know, is the fact that it is, it can be a sole agent strictly by itself, you know, in the field. You got to remember, you may find gas anesthesia in the strangest places. One of the things about ether is that in third world countries, you can produce it. Hell, you can produce it in the local high school chemistry lab. It's that easy to kind of do. It's incredibly cheap. And in fact, I was reading an article not too long ago where they were suggesting that maybe all these countries ought to be producing their own ether instead of trying to buy these more expensive anesthesia gases, and they could do a lot more with less, you know, kind of a deal. So it can work in the, you know, the austere environment. You would also be surprised where you may find halothane out there, you know, which comes in kind of a reddish labeled bottle. Isoflurane's been around a long time. It's cheap. You know, you can find it out there. It's in kind of a purplish label color bottle type of a deal. So the other thing to think about too is, you know, where to get it. Other places, veterinary clinics use isoflurane every day. Mm-hmm. You know, they use it. It's the same stuff, you know, and they have vaporizers too. I'm just saying, not advocating anything, just saying where you can find stuff. All right. And the other thing about gas is if you are in a severely limited supply situation and you have it, you have options that you may not have with some of the other things. You know, if I'm out of ketamine, I'm out of IV tubing, I'm out of all these things, it may be it, you know. And people ask, like, well, do I have to start an IV, you know, to do gas anesthesia? And the answer is absolutely if you have it, but they did it for a long time without having IVs. You know, I'll just say that. You know what I mean? Back to that thing I said before. If you have it, absolutely use it. But if you were in the worst case scenario and you're like, I don't have it, you know, can I sedate this person, you know, with gas and an open drop technique? And yeah, you actually could do that. And it's covering all the pillars that you would need it to do. Some of the cons of it would be back to the delivery method though. You know, if I'm using some of those techniques, the waste gas, you know, the fact that I have to go through stage two to get them down to stage three, just putting them to sleep, and that's a danger zone versus if I was able to use some IV agent to help me out. In the field, the lack of monitoring that you just don't have in the that the hospital has, you know, so I cannot see that MAC value that I would really like to be able to see. It does, gas will, and depending on the agent, it does cause cardiovascular suppression the deeper that you go. And a lot of times that starts on the arterial blood pressure side, but will eventually move over into cardiac output in those areas as well, the deeper I go. I will tell you, in trauma, in the hospital, even if we put somebody to sleep, they have to prove to us to be able to turn the gas on, because many a time with somebody who has a low blood pressure will say, and you're like, I think I can turn the gas on, and you just crack the vaporizer open, you know, and the next blood pressure is like, boom, you know, like, oh, you know, I can't turn it off fast enough yet, you know, that kind of a deal.
Yeah.
So it will get there. The other thing that it does, especially ether, good Lord, post-op nausea and vomiting when they're waking up. You used to hear all the stories of people just yakking their brains out. But there's 30, 35% of people waking up for ether that are going to puke, you know, not quite as much with like a halothane or an isoflurane, but even those, you know, there's, you know, post-op nausea and vomiting, you know, just be ready for it. If you have Zofran, you can give them beforehand. Absolutely do that. And one of the other things that anesthesia gas does, it inhibits what's called hypoxic pulmonary vasoconstriction, or HPV is what we call it. HPV is a body's compensatory mechanism in the lungs that if a part of the lung tissue is not being ventilated very well, the body will shunt the blood away from that area to areas that are getting better ventilated, and that keeps my pulse ox up, okay? But the gas agents inhibit that function. Now, in the operating room, we're always given supplemental oxygen, and so you don't see the dips in the pulse ox because you're given supplemental oxygen. But the chance of having supplemental oxygen in, you know, the austere environment is very low, right? Yeah. So you are going to see the pulse ox. It may start out, you know, 98, and then it starts to come down. And it may start hovering at 94, 95 because of that very reason, that it's blocking that response. And it'll fool you a little bit if you're not kind of thinking through, okay, what's going on kind of deal. If I had supplemental oxygen in the field, am I going to use it? Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it will keep that number back up higher as well. But just something to consider. Contraindications as far as the gas anesthesia, there's one big one. It's not very common, but it's malignant hypothermia, a history of it, or a family history of it. There's a special test that has to be done to even know that if you've actually got it. But if you have a history of malignant hypothermia, or maybe your dad had a history of it, or you do not want to give them gas, because if they go into a malignant hypothermia, you don't have there's only a drug to use, and it's dantrolene, and you don't have it. You're not going to have it. And it's a whole bunch of it. In fact, there's a very special cart in the operating room. You can ask, just like a crash cart. It's called the malignant hypothermia cart. It's a whole cart. You know what I mean? It's full of dantrolene. And also in there is the stuff to mix it up. And it takes like one to two people to do nothing but mix it, to hand it off, to give it. You know, it's that kind of involved. You don't want it. You don't want any part of that. So if for any reason you had a team member that said, you know, my dad had it, or just say no, just do something else. You know what I mean? Give them a fifth of Jack Daniels and say, I'm sorry, dude, this is the best we can do. You know what I mean? But you don't want to use it. And then the other really contraindication, like I was talking about before, is if you are considering using ether, is any kind of open flame. Any kind of thing that's going to produce a spark, any kind of electric cautery or anything along those lines, you're just going to have to be very vigilant of the fact that, you know, that ether could ignite. And, you know, like I said, it's in the tissues of the body. So, you know, back then, if you were to do that and ignite, it could literally ignite the internal part of the body. You know, if you're doing an open abdomen case, like, it could be on fire, and that would be the most, I don't know, horrifying thing ever. So just, you know, just say no. Now, I say that because all your surgeons, you know, use electric cautery. I mean, come on. And, you know, like, back to, you know, talking with Dave Harden, you know, over in Africa, you know, if he had it, he would be using it. It's just, he didn't have it a lot. You know, or maybe not at all at times, you know, and it's like, okay. But you definitely want to be the person that says, okay, we're going to use ether. All right. Before we do this, number one, you know, here's the thing we're not going to do, kind of a deal. So,
Yeah. So just a quick thing on ether, and obviously you need ventilation. It goes to the ground. Could you just roll up if you happen to have a tent or doors or whatever that's low? Could you just open them and vent that off quicker, or are you just inviting more fire things around?
Well, you know, you would have to look and see, like, where is it going? Which way is the wind blowing? And the more that it gets out into the atmosphere, it's going to dissipate out, to the point where it's not going to ignite. It's just, we tend to do these things in places like, I don't know, we're talking about doing this in like back of a vehicle or a small safe house room or all these areas where there's not a lot of ventilation. I would absolutely love ventilation. And if you have that ability to be able to, open that door, just be mindful of where it's going to tend to go. Where's the airflow going? And therefore, where is it going to go seek out, kind of a deal. So you got to remember the other thing about ether, it burns clean. So it's like Ricky Bobby on fire. What I mean? It's like, you can't see it. You can't see it,
You can feel it, I'm sure.
You can feel it. But that would be the other danger of it, is that it would burn clean unless, something else was going on. But, so there's that. But again, it's like, oh my God, and it's like, but you got to remember, 1846 to 19, almost 80, they were doing this every single day in the operating room and doing it well and, safely. Right. You know what I mean? Are we safer now? Sure. Absolutely. We've made a lot of progress. Progress doesn't live in some of the countries that we're in. It just doesn't.
That's true.
And there's times we just have to figure things out. And, a lot too, what we're talking about is a lot of the cases that we're really talking about are more sedation anyway. Mm-hmm. And so could I safely sedate, my patient to do this small procedure if all I had was gas? And the answer is absolutely you could. Just be very vigilant. Mm-hmm. And watch for those warning signs of stage two. Get to the operating room. Go in and watch those cases, not only to see the beginning of them, but absolutely. I mean, specifically go in and say, I am here to look at the aspects of gas anesthesia, to see it on the monitor, to see it on the, coming, how it works out of the vaporizer, where the waste gas is going here. But more importantly, that waking up, what does stage three look like? What does stage two especially look like? And then what does that stage one look like just as they're coming back? And if I can do that, I promise you that is one of those things that it ingrains in your brain. You just don't forget, that's one of those events. You know what I mean? Yep. It's not like you'd have to get in there once a week or anything. You get in there a couple of times and really see that, it will solidify in your brain of what that looks like. So that would be my biggest thing for people is get in there, do some things, practice what you can with what you're allowed to do. But then that way, you're not just reading about it in the book and pulling it out at the last second, God, I saw the video from 1944, hold my beer, watch this, what I mean? Right. But it's a great video. I'll just say that it's pretty good. And you got to love the narration back then. Those people knew how to talk on video, not like me. You know what I mean? They had proper people speaking on a video. You know what I mean? Nice. So nice. Yeah, it was good stuff, man. So
perfect. Yeah. Perfect. Well, thank you, Brad. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. It was fun, man. It's always fun to dig into some of these topics.
For today's podcast, be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Our boy is waiting there for you.